Well, good morning, everyone. I know that you're loving sitting in the sun this morning, aren't you? I was just telling Robbie and Rebecca here that I have a neighbor who, he was a barber and didn't attend church very often, but he'd come and listen to me preach every once in a while, and he'd say, "Dan, I need your sermon today to be about two things. I need it to be about Jesus, and I need it to be about 10 minutes. So I may not give you 10 minutes this morning, but we're going to open ourselves to see what God has for us. Claire and I, we live in Rochester, Minnesota, which is the home of the Mayo Clinic. So I know a lot of docs. And I know one cardiologist, and he has a question that he likes to ask a lot of people, usually his patients, but you know docs. They like to ask their sort of doctor questions to anybody that comes into their path. And one of his questions is just simply this: how's your heart? How's your heart? Now, when he asks that question, he wants to know, how are you doing physically? Are you eating right? Are you exercising? Are you resting? Are you getting a good night's sleep? And some of our answers are, yeah, no, maybe, I don't know. But this morning, I want to ask the question in a little different way. I want to ask you, how's your heart doing spiritually? How are you doing in the inside? In that place at the deepest levels where you have some of those most important questions. In that area where you may have your deepest pain. In that area where you may have your most significant doubts. In that place where you have your deepest intimacies. But even maybe more important is the question, how do you know? I mean, how do we gauge this? How do we measure how our heart's doing? How do we know how well we're doing? You know, one of the ways a doctor would evaluate the physical health of a heart is to administer a series of stress-inducing tests. And some of you may have been through these. There's the treadmill test, there's the endocardiogram. For those of us from Minnesota, in Indiana, it's watching the Colts and the Vikings. All these things can just leave us totally frazzled, can't they? But what happens is if you have a heart condition of some kind, it's most likely to show up. The signs and the symptoms are most likely to show up when you're under stress. And the same thing is true about our spiritual heart, guys. Recently, I was walking to my car. And as I got closer to my car, I noticed something on my car that made my heart sink. There was a little piece of paper tucked under the windshield wiper. I quickly looked around, and about a half a block down the street, I saw the guy, the parking patrol guy, motoring around. You've seen them before in their glorified golf carts. And you'd think I'd have more important things in my life, but all of a sudden, anger just started building up in me. How could I be getting a parking ticket? I'm only a few minutes late. There's plenty of open spaces around. I mean, the reason I was downtown even was because I was helping someone. But all of a sudden, I'm starting to get really upset. And this anger is just starting to bubble in my heart. And I started thinking, you know what? I'm going to go down and I'm going to talk to this guy about this. I'm going to speak for the people who have gotten parking tickets in their life. I am the new ambassador for the injustice of parking tickets. And you know what else I'm going to do? I'm going to give him the whole, "Don't you know I'm a pastoral counselor? Do you realize your soul is at risk if you fulfill this?" And so I pick up the pace and I get to my car and I pull out that ticket and I look at it. And you know what it is? It's a flyer for discount coffee at the new store that just opened. I think it's safe to say I failed my stress test, wasn't it? You know, we can try to hide our anger, hide our envy, hide our guilt. Whatever is behind that facade of, "I'm doing just fine." But eventually, you guys, it's always going to come out, isn't it? Why? Because it's in our heart. It's in that innermost part of who we are. It's in that place we may try to bury or cover up, but it's always there. And on top of that, it's always trying to find its way out. Listen to how the writer of Proverbs puts it in verse 4:23. Above else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Did you hear those first three words? This is the wisest man that's ever lived. It's the book of wisdom, and he says, everything that I've ever told you up to this point, above all that, guard your heart. Everything you do flows out of your heart, and it's where your heart is. You see, our heart is the hub of our character. Well, what is our character? What makes us who we are today? Well, I think there's two things. The first one is, what is your values? What's most important to you? Dr. Henry Cloud, wonderful Christian psychologist, says, if you want to know what your values are, look at your calendar and look at your bank accounts. Because we make sure that we find time for the things that are most important to us, and we give our resources to the things that are most important to us. The second thing that creates our character is our attitude. And our attitude is towards three things. The first one is, what do I think of God? Do I think that God created me and said, good luck? Or do I actually think that he cares about the details of my life? Do I think he's just generally disappointed in me? He's just waiting to bust me for doing something wrong? Or do I think that he's my greatest advocate? We've got to answer that question. What do I think of God? Second question is this, what do I think of others? A few months ago, I had a guy who walked into my counseling office and he sat down and for the first 10 minutes, he literally didn't take a breath. And he told me about all the idiots in his life. People on the road are idiots. They're trying to run him off the road. Boss is an idiot. Brother-in-law is an idiot. Colleagues are an idiot. Everybody was an idiot. And he went on and on and on and on. And finally he stopped and he's looking at me and I said, it has got to be the most difficult thing to be the most perfect person God ever put on the face of the earth. And there was no expression. And finally I said, you think I'm an idiot too, don't you? And he goes, you're darn right I do. How do you think life works for a person who thinks everybody is an inconvenience in their lives? What do we think of others? That they have value as long as they bring value to us? Or do people have an intrinsic value? Are they of immeasurable value and worth because of who created them? Are they only valuable because they act like us, dress like us, talk like us, vote like us? Or is there something deeper than that? What do we think of others? And the last one is this. What do you think of you? What do I think of me? Psalm 139 says, you were knit together in your mother's womb. You ever watch anybody knit? Haphazard? Intricate. Detailed. And then the next verse says this, and I am fearfully and wonderfully made. In Hebrew, the better interpretation of fearfully is reverently. And because Hebrew is a Semitic language, we should have a picture in our mind of what that word means. And here's what reverently looks like. When we're told to fear God, it doesn't mean we're to cower from him. It means that when we experience the presence of God, it should take our breath away. Did you hear what I said about you? When God got done knitting you together, he did this. Wonderful. I don't know what your self-narrative has been, or what other people have told you of who you are. But the creator gets to identify the created. An artist gets to name their portrait. A potter gets to name their piece of pottery. And God gets to name you. And he says, wonderful. You see, our character is the source of our thought life. And God's most fundamental concern is not with our circumstances or not even in our behavior. God's most fundamental concern in our lives is our heart. So let me ask you again. Honestly, how's your heart this morning? How's your heart doing? If you have your Bibles, would you turn to Luke chapter 18? Today we're going to be looking at the parable, a parable of Jesus, one that reveals some of ways of life, some different types of hearts. We're going to be looking at not only one heart, but we are going to be only looking at one heart that is truly acceptable to God. So if you would follow along with me, starting in verse 9, Luke writes this: to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Can I just stop there for a moment? I think it's absolutely important to note that Luke doesn't tell us precisely who these listeners are. Who is this audience that he's speaking to? We might have assumptions. We may think it's Pharisees. Might be. Might be fishermen. Might be. We don't know. But there's an audience there that he's talking to. And they have a certain heart condition. They were confident in their own righteousness, meaning they trusted in the goodness of their own moral sufficiency in their own hearts. And they may have done this for selfish reasons. They may have done it for religious reasons. They may have done it because they trusted in the goodness of their own hearts, but we just don't know. But that's their heart condition. To people who felt that way about themselves, this is who Jesus is telling this story to. He says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. For crying out loud, I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. But to the tax collector, he stood at a distance. He wouldn't even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast. And he said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. This story begins with two really different guys. Two different individuals are going up to the temple to pray that day. And I think it's curious. What are they doing to, why are they doing this at the temple, and what are they going to pray? Well, let's just look at a little bit of the background of the temple at this time. Twice a day at dawn and at 3 p.m., a priest would make what was called the atonement sacrifice. They'd make the atonement offering on behalf of all the sins of the people of Israel. The atonement service would begin at the outside of the inner sanctuary at the great altar where the lamb without blemish would be sacrificed. When that was completed, some priests would go to the highest point on the temple and they would blow the shofar and they would clash the cymbals. 3 o'clock is also known as the ninth hour. What else happened at the ninth hour? Jesus was crucified. Do you ever wonder how they knew it was at the ninth hour? Because the moment the priests went up and blew the shofar and clashed the cymbals, that noise would have drifted across the Kidron Valley to a man who was nailed to a cross. And he would have heard, the unblemished lamb has now been sacrificed. And at that moment he said, it is finished. The priests, after this took place, would go in the inner sanctuary and they would burn incense. And the people would see this smoke coming out of the temple. And that's when they would begin praying, offering their petitions and their confessions to God. Another example of this is in Luke 1, A lot of you know the story. A priest named Zechariah, father of John the Baptist, is given the duty of burning incense inside the temple during this particular sacrifice. That's what we're talking about here. So a Pharisee and a tax collector go up to the temple to pray, to offer their prayers during the atonement offering. Truly, it's hard to imagine two more opposite people, at least based on their outward appearance, based on their public perception. As you may recall, tax collectors were Jews who were working for the Romans. They were collaborating with their sworn enemy. They were stealing from their own people. And while this particular tax collector is soon going to show a change of heart, we must be first clear about what his life was like that morning as he entered the temple. You see, to be a tax collector was to make a conscious decision to deny God in your faith. The decision was made in order to chase after all the pleasures of life here and now, what's in front of them. Reputation, at least in the Roman culture, was everything. You see, what did it mean to be a tax collector? You actually put in bids to be a tax collector. It was called taxed harvesting. And what would happen is those wanting to be tax collectors would approach the precept of the Romans, and they'd say, we're willing to collect this much money for you. And the highest bid got it. But at that moment, when they were given that role, the Romans then gave them permission to charge whatever they wanted on top of that for their own profit. And what historians tell us is, about the time of Jesus, the tax rate at this point for the Jews was right around 70 to 75%. 70 to 75% was the tax rate. And let's be honest, in many ways, this decision paid off for this guy. He had more resources than other fellow Jews. He lived in better neighborhoods, ate in nicer restaurants. He had more fashionable clothes. He mingled with the rich and powerful. He had friends in high places. Everything that the world would see as, you've made it, he made it. But to be a tax collector meant to be driven by certain convictions. Conviction that the goal of life is to get as much as you can, as fast as you can. It's a good thing that people don't think that way anymore, isn't it? Truth is, our world is driven by that same kind of self-indulgent, kind of morally autonomous kinds of convictions, and the goal of life is to accrue more wealth, more power. And at times, images and persona are more important than integrity and character. Commitments are only really binding as long as they feel useful. Sex is just another way of having a good time. Healthy spirituality, well, that's just whatever makes me feel more comfortable about me. You see, these kinds of convictions are all over our society. We see it in our world. We see it in our media. We see it in the lives and of some of our family and our friends and our coworkers and our colleagues. And guess where else they're at? They're here, too. They're in my heart at times. And they're in your heart at times, too. A few months ago, I met a man for counseling, and he had an extremely high-paying job with an investment firm. And he was uber successful. He made a living helping the super rich get super richer. And man, did he had the right look for it, too. He wore the right clothes. He talked about the right friends. He mingled with the rich and powerful. He traveled where and when he wanted, and it was always first class. He had all the worldly traits, the worldly characteristics of a guy who made it. And I got to admit, there was a part of me that sort of felt jealous, felt this jealousy started to rise up in me for all the privilege in his life. Sometimes similar to my everyday life when I see somebody who's got something that I think would be great in my life. You see, just because I don't have the means to live out this life doesn't mean that the same sorts of self-indulgent, morally autonomous kinds of convictions and sins aren't in my heart. Because they are. But what was really striking about my conversation that day was how unsettled and how unsatisfied this guy really was. In fact, he told me he had booked the nicest room in the most expensive hotel in Aspen, Colorado, so he could get away and try to figure out his life. How to try to find some peace and perspective in his life. But he was already worried it would just feel like the same old, same old. So I think I'm a pretty empathetic guy. So I looked at him, and I had compassion in my soul, and I said, if it would help you, I'd be willing to stay in that room and give you the gift of benevolence. I didn't say that. Check to see if you're listening. You see, at some point in time, every self-indulgent heart is going to start looking up to a temple. And we're going to pray because we realize there's got to be more than what I'm experiencing right here. They're going to start looking for another way to fill their heart because this way leads to emptiness, because our hearts were not to be overflowing with worldly power and pleasure. Our hearts are absolutely meant to be filled with God. And only God can fill us, and only God can fulfill us. And that's what this wealthy tax collector eventually figured out. Nothing else was satisfying. Nothing else was filling him up. Nothing else was working in his life. His heart, he realized, one day was absolutely empty. He realized he had a heart problem. So where do I go? I show up at the temple one day. And we're going to get to what he does in just a minute. But there was a second man who came to the temple that day. A guy who looked a lot different than the tax collector. Now, Pharisees, they often get a bad rap in the Gospels, but in many of these cases, these people are pretty well-motivated people. They long to be holy. They long to please God in their lives. There's nothing wrong with that. They actually long for other people to be holy, for other people to please God. I mean, if we just look at it at the surface level, their motives are pretty accurate. But their problem was not the desire to be holy. Their problem was the concept of holiness in their lives. You see, for the Pharisee, holiness boiled down to the conformity of the rules. The following of the law as perfectly as they could. God would be merciful, but only to those who could prove themselves to measure up and be faithful. In other words, the Pharisees' righteousness, their hearts came to feel justified by this form of self-righteousness. Even moral superiority. That is, I'm more acceptable with God because I'm better at keeping the rules than some of the other people I know. Just think back for a moment on that Pharisee's prayer. How did he pray? Verse 11. And I love this. When you can just take a moment to observe. First thing it says, he stood by himself. He stood away from everyone else. I don't even want to get close to those people, those sinners. It's a sense of superiority. Then he prays his own actions. Jesus tells us, he says, I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. Like this is extra credit in God's economy. All this just sort of reeks of this spiritual arrogance and pride that becomes most clearly visible when he compares himself to others. Thank God I'm not like those sinners. Thank God I don't have their problems. Thank God I'm not as much of a liar or a cheat or a sexual deviant as someone who is much more clearly offensive to God than me. Thank God I'm not like all the other people out there. Thank God I'm not like all the folks at the office. Thank God I'm not like the people at the gym. Thank God I'm not living how those lowlifes are living. Isn't it a good thing we don't ever think that way? See, the truth is, at times, our hearts can be as tainted with that same type of spiritual arrogance. There's a lot of stuff going on in this world. How do we see others? It's part of our character. We find ourselves thinking things like, at least my sins aren't as bad as theirs, and we feel justified by that. We find ourselves thinking, I do what God asked me to do at least most of the time. I mean, I have to be okay with him. And we respect the big rules, right? Can I poke a little more? Can I dig a little deeper? Because I did it with myself before I came here and I didn't like what I saw in the mirror sometimes. Maybe we even find ourselves thinking, you know, those people out there, they may be having fun now, but just wait till they see what's coming their way. Do we honestly believe that's what God sees when he sees people who live outside of his will? It says he wept because they were like sheep without a shepherd. He didn't go, one day they're going to get theirs. Well, I hope one day I don't get mine. That's why I need mercy today. We have to check our hearts. And now I'm not saying God isn't holy. I'm not saying God doesn't care about sin or isn't going to do something about it, and he's not going to be just. He's a God of truth and grace, and he's full of both. But if we base our spiritual confidence, our righteousness on the fact that somebody else is doing worse, or if we find ourselves hoping those sinners out there will get what they deserve, we got a big Pharisee problem in our heart. And I'll be the first one to admit that I have a lot of Pharisee in my heart. I've been a Christian for over 40 years. I've been attending church most of my life. I've worked hard to obey God. I've worked hard to keep the rules, at least the big ones of don't drink or chew or go out with girls that do. But when I screw up, I promise to do better. I promise to have my act together if somehow that's what makes me acceptable to God. There again, I'm just holding confidence in my own ability to get my own righteousness. We don't want to be those kind of people. We're looking for a world that is looking for hope. And they're looking for people who believe this and live this. And in humility, understand we can't do this by ourselves. It's not just because we end up looking arrogant and self-righteous like the Pharisee in this story, but look what happens at the end of the story. The Pharisee doesn't go home justified. The whole time his heart has been just as lost as that tax collector. And that's the brilliant part of this story. The tax collector and the Pharisee, two people whose outward lives look altogether different, couldn't look any more opposite, arrive at the temple with the exact same problem. And it's called sin. You and I, we'd like to think of sin basically as a behavioral issue. It has nothing to do with behavior. Our character is the filter by which we behave. As a therapist, I can tell you when people come in and say, I need to do behavior modification, unless it's a mental health issue, I say, good luck with that. We need character transformation to arrive at behavior modification. We don't change our behavior. We do that temporarily. But if we want to be different people, it takes character transformation to equal behavior modification. The core problem for self-indulgent tax collector, and it's the core problem for self-righteous Pharisees. And guys, it's the core problem for us as well. But Jesus tells his parable to teach another way. There's a third way. And here's where we pick up our story with the surprising action of that tax collector. Verse 13. Again, take in what's going on here. It starts out, but the tax collector stood at a distance. He showed up that morning. He stood at a distance. Because you have to have in mind the understanding of what the temple was. The first thing was the Holy of Holies. Then there was the next area. The high priest can only go in there. Then there's the inner sanctuary, then the outer courts, then the court of the Gentiles, and so on. What is he saying? I don't even deserve to stand in the place of the court of the Gentiles, hardly. I am so far away from God, I need to go stand off by myself. I'm not even worthy. I have no business even being here this morning. And he stands there as an act of great humility because he knows his heart. He doesn't deserve there. He doesn't deserve God's mercy for what he's done. And then the next part, I love this. The text says, he started beating his breast. This is kind of a gesture was only used in times of extreme grief and anguish in a person's life. It's absolutely rare. And you know it's so rare that it is only used one other time in all of Scripture. After Jesus breathed his last and died on a cross, Luke 23:48, Luke writes that all who watched this take place beat their hearts and walked away. They just saw hope die. There's no words except this tax collector has this demonstration of incredible grief. This ultimate anguish. Why? Because he realized how far away his heart was from God. And no words could explain that. You see, he wasn't embarrassed because he got caught. He wasn't frustrated. He's going through the pain of consequences of his sin. He was grievous because of where his heart was. And what he hopes so desperately for. And when we realize that there's only one option, and this is where we come to the heart of the story, in fact, the heart of the gospel. In Jesus' parable, the tax collector prayed, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. There's no phrase more central to salvation than this one. But I think it's absolutely important that we understand that Luke does not use the normal Greek word for mercy here. He uses a word that literally means to make an atonement for, as if to say, God, make an atonement for me, make a sacrifice for me. Do this. I can't do it on my own. My heart is absolutely broken and incapable of doing this. He doesn't just say, I'm a sinner. The literal translation of this is, God have mercy on me, the sinner. Not a sinner. No comparing myself to anyone else here. I understand where I'm at. The sinner, as if to say, I'm not just a sinner among others. I'm not comparing myself to others. I'm not justified by relative goodness. God, this is just about you. And it's about me. And it's about my heart. There's no sense of feeling better off because someone else is doing worse. All he knows for sure is he has a heart problem, and it's one he can't fix on his own. So he simply humbles himself. He feels the pain of his own brokenness. He has nothing to offer, no promises to make. He doesn't promise to change his life. He doesn't promise to measure up. That's the Pharisee way. He has no confidence in himself at this point. At this point, as the incense of atonement rises out of the temple, he offers the absolutely only plea he can. God, may this atonement please be true for me right now. May this sacrifice be true. And please, would you allow it to be good and acceptable for me, the sinner? Have you ever been at that place? Have you ever been at that place where you start going through the files of the past and the present, and there's nowhere else to place those documents except at the feet of Jesus? I've tried to compare. I'm not as bad. I promise I'm going to do better next time. No. Just being honest, it's not a fun place to be, but it's the bridge that leads to peace and freedom in our lives. You see, today we've come to a pretty impressive temple, haven't we? And some of our hearts may be a mix of that self-indulgent tax collector and maybe that self-righteous Pharisee. Before us is not just an atoning sacrifice. Before us is the atoning sacrifice. Before us is the cross, where Jesus Christ, our unblemished Lamb, took upon himself all the sins of not only the world, but of you and me. He did not just become a sinner, he became the sinner in that act. And the once for all time sacrifice for us. He has made a way when we could not, so each of us could receive a new heart and a new life in this life and the next. And there's no other word except mercy. There's no other word except grace, because we don't deserve it. But he loves us. In order to receive it, like that tax collector, we have to repent. We have to own up to where our heart really is. We have to own up to what's really going on inside of us. And I know this isn't an easy thing sometimes. Many years ago, I was pulling my car out of the garage at home, and I was impatient, and I was in a hurry, and I forgot to look to see how close I was to the edge of the garage. And then the side mirror hit the garage, and it snapped off. And this was a time in our life where we didn't have a lot of resources, and finances were really tight. And as much as I wanted to pretend it didn't happen, I had to prepare for an honest confessional conversation with my wife, Claire. And I said, "Claire, I want you to know how much I love our home. I want you to know how much I love our car. It's a gift from God, and I work hard to take care of it, but I want to be completely honest with you about what happened. Today, when I was leaving home for work, to my surprise, I found William, our treasured son, had broke your mirror." Anybody else in their life like to blame William? Sometimes Williams are easy to find, aren't they? It's a lot harder to hold up the mirror to Dan and to you. I can think of many times in my life where I have said, you know, I can walk out of this room and my heart is okay. I didn't need that message. Because I don't like admitting I have a sin problem. One that goes all the way down to the innermost part of who I am. And I want you to know, you may be coming here today thinking, boy, Dan's making a gospel presentation, I am. And for some of you, it may be a first-time decision you make on this, but the other ones, what I hear is this: God's mercies are new every single day. And if you're thinking, I've accepted Christ, I rejoice with you. But do you need his mercy today? Have you found yourself getting lost in the vortex of the tax collector? Or have you found yourself finding that security in, I do the right things and God likes me? But I think there's got to be something more. You see, the hard news, the confrontational news of this story is only one of these individuals went home justified. Only one had an acceptable heart, and it wasn't the one who thought he was doing okay. It wasn't the one who thought his ability to follow all the rules made him worthy of God's love. It wasn't the one who thought the determination of obedience was enough to be justified before God. It was the one who knew it isn't, the one who knew he couldn't, and it was the one who said, God, I have no other way. I have to have you make a way for me. And the good news of the story is today that person can be you. Jesus, please make this true for me today. I want to give you a chance right now to make that your prayer. This isn't about a religious ritual. This is just a way to have a moment with you and God, an authentic, real encounter with Jesus. And if you can put away some of the distractions about what's going to be coming up later today and just give yourself the freedom to not worry about what anyone else around you is doing, this is a time for you to come before the cross of Christ. I'm a firm believer of physical symbolism. And maybe today, when you say this prayer, maybe you just need to go, I want to give you a chance to pray that beautiful, liberating prayer, the prayer of an honest heart. Jesus, have mercy on me. In whatever details, in whatever way you need to say that prayer, I want to invite you to say, God, please make the atonement for me today. You can confess that you can't do it on your own. Five simple words. Jesus, have mercy on me. If you aren't quite ready this morning to make that prayer yours, I want to challenge you to spend some time this week and ask the question, how is my heart really doing? Not how is my heart doing, how is my heart really doing? What is it I'm living for? What is it I believe justifies me? And what's going to make it right? Let's pray. Jesus, we are so grateful for your sacrifice on the cross for each of us. The sheer mercy and utter grace that you loved us first, that salvation does not depend on me or anyone else in this room. Jesus, have mercy on us. We're grateful you made a way when there was no other way. As we begin this week, we give you our hearts. We lay them before you. May our hearts be right with you this day. May our hearts be right with you this day. We pray this in your great and merciful name. Amen.